am Gillian Strain, and welcome to the Go Health Podcast. In this season, we are exploring the theme of learning to heal. We all learn in all sorts of different ways every day, but in the Go Health Podcast, we are learning to heal by listening to the stories and experiences of others. And in doing so, we might be learning to heal ourselves, or learning to be a source of healing for others, or both. In Go Health, we take up the call of Jesus to help others to find healing. And we know that we all need healing all the time. So this podcast is, we hope, hitting that nail on the head in both ways. If you haven't done so already, please rate and subscribe the podcast. This helps others to find it. In this episode of the Go Health Podcast, I'm chatting with Claire Gilbert. At the age of 54, Claire was diagnosed with myeloma, an incurable cancer of the blood. The prognosis ranged from surviving only a few months to living for several decades, with no guarantee of which outcome was to be hers. Claire, director of Westminster Abbey Institute and a national expert on the ethics of medical research on humans, was to find herself experiencing new treatments firsthand. Her new book, Miles to Go Before I Sleep, is formed of letters she wrote to her dear readers, friends who she asked to accompany her on the journey. This book is an exquisite account of the power of the human spirit in the face of mortality, an unexpectedly exuberant account of how, through her terminal diagnosis, Claire has learned to live fully with joy and defiance. It's an exploration of how faith is no simple solace, but provides a whole new plane of meaning during these liminal moments. Claire Gilbert's story is deep, powerful, and challenging, a truly sacramental story about a devastating diagnosis, but it's not a book about dying. It's truly a book about how to live. So Claire, thank you so much for joining me today on the Go Health Podcast. And this is not that we have met before, right? So I was trying to think back. The first time I met you was in London when we were doing some work on the environment. Do you remember? Yeah. And so tell us a bit about your day job now. What's your day job and how did you get doing that?
So now I run Westminster Abbey Institute and I'm the founding director of it. It was founded in autumn 2013 to work with the public servants and public service institutions that sit in close proximity to Westminster Abbey on Parliament Square, with the Houses of Parliament to the east, the Treasury and all of Whitehall to the north, the Supreme Court since 2009 to the west, and the Abbey on the fourth side. So the Institute is the answer to the question, what's Westminster Abbey doing to support public service, people of goodwill in public service values? And we have lectures and dialogues, public ones, and then we have invitation-only seminars for government departments and others. And we have a fellows program of younger public servants from all different walks of public life, whom we work with for a year. And it's all geared towards nurturing and revitalizing moral and spiritual values in public life and for people of all faiths and no faith as well.
Well, that sounds like a whole separate podcast I now want to do about that bit of your life. Really pleased to welcome you on this podcast to chat about your experience. You've published a book recently called Miles to Go Before I Sleep, which is the journey, the beginning of your journey through getting diagnosed with cancer. And on this podcast, we invite loads of interesting people on to tell us a bit about what they've gone through, because we believe strongly that's in our stories, that when we tell our stories, when we listen to stories, that we could find healing. And so can you tell us when you were diagnosed, what your diagnosis and what you've been through and where you are now today, sitting here talking to me?
So somewhat by accident, because it was really looking for something else, and only in order to sort out an insurance policy. Myeloma was found in my blood, or the protein for myeloma was found in my blood. And myeloma is a blood cancer, which is horrible. I mean, once it gets going, it starts eating your bones. And often people aren't diagnosed because it's not thought to be looked for, as it were, until the cancerous proteins have started to eat. They have what they think is a heart attack or a broken rib, or there's some sort of pain in this area. And what's happened is that the myeloma has started eating away at the bone. As one fellow sufferer said to me, my bones were like lace. So that's what it does. But luckily mine was found because of the wonderful, wonderful kidney doctor at Guy's, who looked for it. He's looking at my kidneys. There was a slight anomaly, and that was the test for the insurance company. But he looked for the myeloma cells and found them. And I had a phone call from him where I was in the pub in Hastings. We'd just come down from London for the weekend, having a pint. And I had this phone call completely unexpectedly. And he said, I have found this protein and it could be myeloma. And I didn't know what myeloma was. So he said, well, it's a cancer. So I had this initial shock of the possibility of the diagnosis. And then that awful period that everybody who's had cancer knows, and perhaps more so than ever in the last year, of tests and not knowing and waiting for the diagnosis and trying to prepare myself for the worst. And indeed, on the 8th of March, 2019, the confirmation was given to me that I did have myeloma. It hadn't done any damage, so I was feeling completely healthy. But there was enough of it to justify treatment. And with myeloma, it's incurable. So what they try and do is send it into remission for as long as possible. And they do that by hitting you with as hard treatment as you're really able to take in that initial period in order to do that. And that treatment, Gillian, I am still undergoing. So 2.5 years later, I finish in mid-July. I cannot wait to finish. But and it was given in the context of a clinical trial. So initial batch of chemotherapy, then randomized to having a stem cell transplant or having more chemotherapy. I was randomized to the stem cell transplant, which is horrific. And then 18 months of maintenance chemotherapy, which is still, I mean, every time I have it once a week, and then every 4 weeks I have a week off. Every time I have it for 24 hours, I feel absolutely grim. Although I'm the rest of the time, I don't feel too bad, and I'm able to hold down that job I just described.
Yeah. And were you hospitalized for the stem cell bit? How did that bit work?
Yes, I was. So it's extraordinary therapy, but what they do is they harvest your own stem cells, which is a whole process in itself. And then you, a few weeks later, at University College Hospital, you go to what's called the Cotton Rooms, which is a sort of hotel for people with cancer. And it's a lot cheaper because you're walking well, as it were. Well, so you stay in this hotel room and you walk to the cancer center around the corner until the point when you become so ill, you can't do that anymore. And then you're put in an isolation room in UCLH. And what happens is you're given this enormous dose of a horrific chemotherapy called melphalan, which is based on mustard gas used in the Second World War, which kills off all your stem cells in your bone, kills off your bone marrow. It also kills off all the bacteria in your gut. So from your mouth to your bottom is out of action. It's horribly inaction because you're vomiting and having diarrhea all the time. But because of the bone marrow dying, you become what's called completely neutropenic, which is to say you're absolutely immune compromised, and even the bacteria in your own body become poisonous to you. And it's the point when your temperature goes up to 38, into isolation you go. And that's where I was for 3 weeks, because I came through all right, because a couple of days after the melphalan they give you your own stem cells back, and there's a sort of, I think of it as Good Friday, Easter Saturday, Resurrection Sunday, but it's delayed. So about a week after you've had the melphalan and the stem cells back, you start to feel completely terrible. That's when I went into the isolation room. And you feel completely terrible for a long time, or feels like forever. That's the extended Easter Saturday. And then at some point, your stem cells start to work. They catch on, or they, and then you slowly, slowly claw your way. Actually, the image then I had was the harrowing of hell. Claw your way out of hell, back into being able to being healthy again, having your cells working again, so you're not immune compromised anymore. Mm. And that takes, well, it can take 6 months. It took me 3 months to get back to being as well as I was before I went in. I mean, one of the things about this whole process that's been really counterintuitive and strange is that at no point have I felt ill from my cancer. I have only felt ill, and I have felt horribly ill from the treatment. It's, again, quite common for people with cancers, is that's what makes you feel ill. You go, you think, normally you think, I'm ill, I feel ill, you go and have medicine and the medicine makes you feel better. Well, and this was the opposite.
Yeah. And almost it's an act of faith, isn't it? In this stuff you're doing to your body. Because often they use the war metaphor, you know, she's fighting her battle or he lost the battle. And it's a rubbish metaphor. But in some ways, these very crude tools they use on the, you know, the chemotherapy is a chemical warfare. The operation is the kind of the scalpel or the, you know, so they're very crude weapons in a way. So in some ways, some people think that the, you know, in that regard, the war metaphors are quite illustrative of cancer. But you shook your head when I mentioned the war metaphors. It's something you've obviously discarded.
I have, Gillian, because, apart from anything else, if I'm going to use the war metaphor, I know I'm going to lose the war. So why would I use the war metaphor? Because it's an incurable cancer and it will come back. I mean, the best possible outcome is that I live long enough without it coming back to die of something else. So, you know, this is my mortality that's been presented to me with this cancer. It's not a battle I'm going to win. Yeah. Just as one doesn't win. I mean, this is the lesson to me. One doesn't win the battle against mortality. So honestly, live with it, accept it, turn it into a source of joy, not a source of bitterness. Because if I keep the war metaphor in my mind, I'm going to get bitter. And I was going to do everything I could to not let that happen, not let the cancer be a source of bitterness. Yeah. But you're right. I should just say you're absolutely right about the faith point, that all I was just shown numbers. I could feel nothing. I was shown numbers. And on the basis of those numbers, I've been given this horrible, horrible treatment. And it's absolutely based on my trust in the doctors. Of course, they give full information. But, you know, when you've just had a diagnosis, you're reeling. You don't really understand. Working in medical ethics, which I did for many years, particularly the ethics of medical research on humans, we talked about consent. It's absolutely essential. Every patient should consent. And consent is made up of three parts. It's given by a competent person. It's based on adequate information. And it's not coerced. Mm. Well, I can tell you, I was none of those things. Mm. I wasn't competent. I was reeling. I couldn't take in the information, so I wasn't adequately informed. And I certainly was coerced, not by anybody, but by the situation. Mm. So although I would never for a minute say don't get consent from patients. It's just that because you need to have the right to say no, but what you're saying yes to, you're saying yes to because you trust your doctor and your nurses.
Yeah. So it's about that relationship between yourself and the medical staff as well. Yeah. My experience getting diagnosed is I immediately forgot everything I'd been told. You know, I just couldn't keep any information because you're in shock in a way. So let's just stick with the kind of that diagnosis. And of course, you described it so eloquently. It's not just a moment. It's then we think it's a, but you've got to wait. And then, you know, it's a bit of a journey you're going on there. But being diagnosed with blood cancer, and I similarly had a blood cancer too, that bulky cancers, you know, a breast cancer or a sarcoma or something like that, you can kind of point to it, can't you, and say it's here. And there's a danger there of becoming very dualistic. You know, this bit of my body's bad and it needs to go in order for the rest of the good bits of my body to carry on living. And that's not possible, is it? Because your cancer was in the blood, in the very thing that's moving oxygen. I don't know that much about it, Claire, but moving oxygen, right? You need your blood. You can't get rid of it. So, you know, you didn't have the option of being dualistic, I guess, about this one.
I didn't, and I again, because it's such a vital thing, the blood flowing around the body, bringing life as well as now for me death. I have, and I still do this. It's a conscious meditation of flowing into my blood. It's sort of Ignatian and imaginative, imagining my way into my blood and flowing around my body and sort of loving it and saying, look, you're fine, you're fine, you're wonderful, you're doing a wonderful job, you don't need to make extra proteins. And also thinking of Christ flowing through my blood. I mean, I have to drink a lot of water with this. I have to drink 6 pints of water a day, which is really good, actually. I've never been so hydrated. But this Eucharistic thing of blood and water has been terribly important in the flow of it, and really consciously bringing Christ into that movement of blood as a loving thing, as a tender thing, as a porous, receptive thing, and letting the cancer's part of that, so letting it be loved as well, rather than, yes, I mean, if I had a tumor, I suppose you would hate that thing, you would want it to go, but I can't do that.
And it sounds like because of that you've had a connected deeply with your body. It sounds like this has been related to deepening. Has it been a deepening of faith, or a rediscovery, or an uncovering, or a just, well, there's nothing else? I mean, how, tell us about how, you know, particularly in the initial diagnosis when you were reeling, what your faith meant to you at this time.
I always find it really, really hard to talk about my faith because I don't really understand it. I have always found God undeniable. I don't really have a sentence, I believe in God, although I say it in the creed, and I don't not believe in God, but it's such an undeniable, God is such an undeniable presence that... right from the start of this whole process, there was no absence of God. But the other thing I think I would say is that I'm a bit of a spiritual extremist, which is why I love Julian of Norwich so much, because I think she is too. And I felt right from the start that I needed to make this a God-filled experience, to make it transformative, to deepen everything in me spiritually. And right from the start, it was not going to be separate from what was happening in my body. I made a list of the things I was going to do before I died. I was given on average 10 years to live was the answer to the question, how long have I got, doctor? On average, people like you in your sort of state of health and stage of the disease, on average 10 years. So of course that could be 2 years or 50 years. but anyway, so let's imagine I have 10 years to live. And a lot of the things on that list were to stay beautiful, to really take care of my body, to wear beautiful clothes, to ride horses, to swim in the sea, but then there was also to write, which has always been my greatest solace and my way of making sense of things, and to contemplate, to practice contemplation and let that contemplation be deeper and deeper. And I might say, as I'm trudging through this, what feels like endless maintenance treatment, the feeling that, I mean, it feels like almost worse now because there's nothing dramatic about it. It's just horrible every single week for 24 hours. I know tomorrow I've got my treatment and tomorrow evening I'm going to feel like absolute rubbish. And that I've somehow, the contemplation, this is almost the more testing time. The contemplation has to go deeper. So I'm the sort of spiritual extremism of the stem cell transplant, when everything in me died, you know, and I was feeling so, so, so ill, I thought, I'm going to die and be reborn. And this is really what Julian asks for. I'm going to let this thing that's happening to my body be something that I'm going to be transplanted in my spiritual marrow, I wrote and thought. But now it's just deepen the contemplation, deepen it. Keep loving your body. I'm keep telling my body how much I love it and how brilliant it's been. It's been receiving this, it's going to make me cry. It's been receiving this poison for 2.5 years and look at it, you know, it's still going strong and being amazing.
Yeah. And I'm really fascinated by that. How this is, you just said, this is a harder bit that every week kind of got dragging yourself back to hospital, knowing it's the right thing, rationally knowing, but your body saying, do it, you know, do you have to do it? Compared to the kind of drama of the stem cell treatments, which sounds really, really tough. And I mean, you've done a PhD in Julian of Norwich, is that right? Yeah. All right. So, you know, here we go with my, you know, school level. But I studied Revelation of Divine Love at Oxford with Benedict Award. So it was very scholastic, very reading commentaries and trying to get it right. And I remember I had this experience of reading the Revelation of Divine Love, not really knowing much about it. And in the Revelations, Julian's praying for an experience of the cross. Of, you know, I'm hoping you're going to nod. I can see you get this right. Experience of the cross, so she can fall deeper into an understanding of what it all means. And that chapter towards the end of the book, where you know you're at the point where she's hoping to see and experience Christ dying, and it's very bloody and gory. And she's there. She's waiting to find out what it means. And suddenly Christ turns to her and says, "Is this enough?" And I remember being so struck by that I was brought to tears going, "God, is this what it's about? You know, it's not just about Jesus dying for our sins to make everything all right again. You know, he's on there experiencing the suffering for us and still asking, is it enough? Because it's such an extraordinary text about suffering and yet it's written in isolation. And I wonder to what extent, I'm curious, you've said of being isolated by your cancer and whether that's been something that's happened, you know, being part of the spiritual journey.
Yes. Well, so in general terms, I think the danger of the difficulty with cancer, with telling people you have cancer, is that you can become the spectre at the feast. You are the reminder of people's mortality. And that can be quite hard to hear. And I forget that actually, because I am completely open about my cancer. I tell everybody I've got it. Perhaps I just want their pity, I don't know. But and most, actually, I will say most people have responded magnificently, even if there's been an initial shock. They've sort of rallied and have said some dreadful things, but then I've said dreadful things to people who've got cancer. I think one realizes in retrospect, but also some wonderful things and been there for me. But yes, so this spectre at the feast and that can feel isolating in general. But then of course there was specifically in the isolation room at UCLH, because of the stem cell transplant, when everything was poisonous to you, that's a strange feeling. The world, the environment, my thesis on Julian was about porosity and the way we can address environmental concerns by an attitude of being absolutely porous to nature around us. And this, I say, is what we, and I still think this is what we need in order to transform the way we live with nature. But here I was being absolutely protected, and everyone who came to see me was masked and gowned and all presaging COVID, of course. And as I say, even bacteria in my own body were becoming poisonous to me. So this sort of feeling of moving. But even then, Gillian, I still tried to practice this porosity and openness and even at the very interior place of my bone marrow, the heart of my bones where the cells were transplanting, to receive them, to be porous to them, to let them work, let them grow. And anybody who did come into my room was extremely welcome. There was one nurse who was a bit frightening, but the rest of them were just completely wonderful. And my beloved partner, Sean, who is the real hero of this story, was there every day, of course, with even standards to keep me sane.
So what helps? You mentioned, you know, people said terrible things, people said good things. What's a good thing to say? What's a good way to be? If you could design your ultimate person.
So the difficult thing about that is, of course, sometimes absolutely anything anybody says is wrong. And sometimes it doesn't matter what they say, it's right. So what I don't have an answer to that question, what's the right thing to say? But what I will say for the person who has cancer is really, really try and remember that people are speaking out of love. And hear the love, not the words. And Sean taught me that, really. And that's what I've tried to practice. But the other thing I would say to the people who accompany the ones who are so unwell, I think it's the hardest place to be when somebody you love is in pain and you can't do anything about the pain. The most important thing is don't go away. Don't turn your back on it. Try not to be afraid of it. Try and sit with it, and love the person. And again, it's a kind of porous feeling of presence and attention, not in that awful pastoral lust kind of way, but just at ease, present at ease. This is something I have to learn to live with. So if you can sit with me and be at ease with this thing that I have to learn to be at ease with, this will help me immeasurably. I remember coming back to Hastings. It was our first, we got back to Hastings the first time after the stem cell transplant because I'd recuperated in London. And the journey had been very difficult, actually, and the train journey and lots of problems. And we got into the house and I lost it. And I was making this noise. I couldn't breathe and I was weeping and I could hardly stand up and I just kind of fell apart. And Sean just stood with me. He put his hand on my back and he just stood with me. He wasn't frightened by what was happening. He just stood with me, and it was immeasurably comforting as the tide of tears and breathlessness and whatever panic passed, and I was back to some kind of equilibrium. Be present, be porous, be loving, be at ease as much as you can. And it's not easy because it's frightening. These things are frightening.
And people want to make it better, don't they? They want to say something, either to make it better or to say it. My experience was that either they want to say something because they want to help or something that indicates they don't want to hear about it. I used to get, "Oh, you look really well," before I'd said anything. I'm like, I did not look well. You know. So, and what I heard was, I don't want to hear how you are. I'm pushing it away. And I think often in churches, with the healing ministry, people, you know, your advice there about just being present is so powerful because we often just want to skip to can I pray for you? And I wonder how you react in church, you know, when people say, can I pray for you? When you have this sort of holistic vision of the presence of God and everything and porous nature of being, you know, intertwined with nature and your body and Jesus, you know, this really well worked. I can't wait for the theology book on this, by the way. Theology of what you're going through. And then somebody says, can I put you on the prayer list? What do you think about that?
Yeah. Oh, look, I'm just really, really, really grateful, Gillian. I mean, come on, we need it. There was one beautiful moment. I think I just need to say something about the dear readers, though, because this has been the absolute saviour to me over this period. And this is where the book came from, that right at the beginning, I asked a group of people if they would let me write to them. And the deal was they had to read. They didn't have to respond. And I definitely didn't want any advice. But actually, they have responded and it's been completely magnificent. And so each week for 2.5, I'm still doing it, for 2.5 years, I've written a diary of what's going on. And it's unexpurgated. It wasn't written for publication originally. So I didn't try and make it nice. I was writing to people who loved me. And I am writing to people who love me and understand me and have given me permission to say the worst possible things as well as the best possible things. And that that gift, that of presence, of reading, has been extraordinarily powerful. But there was one point about a year in, or maybe 6 months in, when one of the readers wrote to me. She's a priest. She wrote to me and she said, "Can I say this, Claire? Let us do the praying. You just sleep." And that was really amazing to read. This, because prayer is like my faith is something I don't really understand or find it quite hard to talk about. And I don't, you know, bringing my name into the presence of God, or how can that not help? And it's certainly this feeling of being, the pillow on which I slept was the pillow of their prayer. It was wonderful. So no, I'm very happy to be on anyone's prayer list, and I'm very moved whenever anyone says that my name is there.
I was really struck in your decision to write, and in the way you described the importance of writing. But writing and having it read, it sounds like it's double. It wasn't just writing and putting it in a drawer somewhere. It was writing it and knowing people that loved you were reading it. So it seems like you're saying that this was something that helped you come to terms with what you're going through, help you process it, and helped you find some, would you say, some sense of healing in what you're going through, that you were able to, that your story was out there?
Yes, it's the reciprocity of the activity that because I had the readers, that made me write, because I didn't always want to write, but actual act of writing for me is healing. It has a healing effect. It's my fingers. I keep my fingernails very short because the pads of my fingers on the keyboard, I think it's a bit like for a pianist, this is a very creative thing. I'm just showing Gillian my fingers going like as if I'm playing typing on the keyboard, and if I don't feel I have anything to say, but I just keep typing. Even I type, I don't know what to say, and then something starts to happen and something starts to move creatively, and then the words emerge, and the words as they emerge tell me what's going on. And I do try to make them beautiful, truthful, and funny as well. One great encounter early on with a great friend whom I asked if he would become a dear reader. He said to me, "Oh yes, I'll do that. That's all right, Claire. You can write to me." I've made it clear this is a great help to me if he would do this. And he said that a friend of his had gone into prison and asked if he could write to them, to Jonathan and his wife, and he said yes, of course. And he said, but the thing is, after a couple of weeks, it got really, really boring. And so I still have this. I must not bore Jonathan in writing, and that's a great boost, you know. Because it makes me really try hard with the writing to make it compelling. And but the compelling nature of it is in the present truthfulness of it. I realize as I look back at it now.
And something about the human relationship, like, let's make it interesting because you're writing to somebody. And I think often with cancer, you know, it's terribly serious and you can't ever say anything. And I remember being, I was much younger than you when I was ill, but, you know, nobody wanted to hear it because it made people uncomfortable. But I kept thinking, well, come on, the funny things happened on the chemo ward and I'm meeting really extraordinary people. And it's my human experience as well. And something about communicating that's important. And
it's vital. It's vital. Human is vital.
Yeah,
I can't tell you how important it is. And I have felt that of all the people serving us over the last year, the comedians have been among the greatest because they have kept us laughing. Laughter is such a tonic. And there are some jokes in the Dear Readers letters, and people would send me jokes too. It's so important. And yes, I mean, the experience of the not working systems in the NHS and the dear funny people, as you say, that you're surrounded by in the chemotherapy suite, and there is so much humor there, and it's really important, really healing.
We sort of pre-arranged for you to read a bit of the book, and it was a bit about where you got your hair shaved, and you had an interaction with a hairdresser, and it really struck me, this bit, because when I was ill, the most important person, and I would say I was healed via loads of drugs and therapies, quite a lot of psychotherapy afterwards. You know, there's a lot of people involved in my healing, including God. But the person that I think of particularly was my chemotherapy nurse, Jeff. Actually, I bumped into Jeff last week randomly in the street in Aberdeen. So yeah, I feel a bit emotional because he's still in part of my life in a way. And this was 20 years ago, but he was a gay secular Jew. We don't have that much in common really on paper.
But you know what? He sat with me through every single chemotherapy for hours and hours and hours, because my one had to go in really slowly by hand. And, you know, and for me, then I went back to meet him 7 years later after I was in remission. And that was the pinnacle of my healing experience, because I went back to meet the person who was present to me. And I wondered if you would mind reading that bit of, from your book about losing your hair and the presence of a hairdresser, because I think it's so extraordinary and gets into the nuance of what it's all about.
Yes. Yes. I love this bit, but in a way it epitomizes the whole thing, because it was the worst thing and it became the best thing. But let me read it. And there's a bit before just about my feeling about losing hair, because that sets it up. So this is Monday, the 7th of October. Hanks of hair coming out in my hands in the bath and at the sink. More is on my head than is coming off. I keep muttering, my heart hammering as the ball of hair grows and grows. I didn't wash my hair yesterday. Would washing it make things worse, or just reveal the inevitable? This morning I have to wash it, and my bath swims with hair. I, who cannot bear a single hair dallying in the bathroom or on my clothes or anywhere apart from people's heads, I, who am avid about clearing up my own hair mess in a bathroom, I am wading through hair. I am just as avid cleaning up now, but the task is Herculean. My Augean stable keeps filling up as more hairs fall from my head, catch in my comb, settle in the sink. Hercules had a day. I have a train to catch. I don't know if I'm making things worse by washing it, but once I have started, I can't stop. I have to comb it out. I have to dress it. I am as gentle as my shaking hands can be. Eventually it is done, and it looks normal. You wouldn't notice. But I have hands full of hair to show Sean. He suggests an artist might make something of it, and we remember Mona Hatoum, whose enormous installations featured quantities of hair twisted and woven and turned into rope and curtain. I like the metaphor, but hate the reality. I really dislike that work. I think of concentration camps and the use to which inmates' hair was put after the heads had been shaven. The only place for my great switch of hair is the compost, making new life. I hope it does. I think this is a good rehearsal. It is such a shock. And if I have the stem cell transplant and it all falls out, I have had a taste of what this is like. I wasn't expecting it to fall out at this stage, you see. This is for the stem cell harvest. We were told we'd lose our hair only in the stem cell transplant, but it came out with this other chemotherapy. I have a taste of what that is like. It cannot be hidden, you see. Everything else I have gone through is on the inside. I can hide away during the sickness, put makeup and a smile on my face. I've enjoyed being told how well I look, defiant in the face of the challenge of cancer. But everyone will see the hair loss. And however quickly my friends will get used to how I look, the initial view is a shock. And for the general public, baldness on women is just weird. Thursday, 10th October. I am to have the transplant. So the worst has happened, and I'm still upright. I'm not now letting myself think for one moment, well, just one briefly, about what might have been, about the fact that my life might have resembled something relatively close to normal if the result had gone the other way. I determined this. Even as my bone marrow is destroyed by the killer chemotherapy melphalan, and my harvested stem cells return to me for my rebirth, I will let myself be transformed in my spiritual marrow. I determine that this will be an experience to relish and be changed by for the better, not something to shrink from and wish away. But oh, expletive, 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 expletive. Hearing this feels worse than hearing the original diagnosis of cancer, believe it or not. Friday, the 11th of October. How do you make a line shorter without doing anything to the line? You draw a longer line next to it. Now I'm not at all troubled by my hair falling out. There's no need to hang on to it. It falls like autumn leaves from a tree preparing for winter. It will all go, and in the spring it will return. It is not precious to me anymore, not this failing thatch. My hair keeps falling out, this is outside the diary. My hair keeps falling out until finally, when I wash it, what little is left turns into a matted lump on top of my head. I can do nothing with it, nothing at all. Monday, 14th October. I look at myself in the mirror inquiringly. This tangle has precipitated the moment, but I am ready. Ready to shave it all off. I am to be shriven before I enter my anchor hold. Encouraged by Sean, who is rightly convinced that for this task I need a barber's shaver, not scissors, we enter a barber's in Newcomen Street near Guy's. It's a gentleman's barber. I speak to the man at the desk who has a kind face. I'm not a gentleman, I say, but I have to shave my hair off because it's falling out anyway from chemotherapy. I have cancer. His face softens and he says, of course, and ushers me to a chair. I remove my cap and reveal the ruination of my head of hair. Sean sits in quiet attendance. Then this angel of a man gently, oh so gently, shaves my head, carefully approaching the tangled knot, working his way over the contours of my scalp, leaving an inch of hair which is mercifully still evenly distributed, a silver grey, revealing my head, revealing me. I look at myself in the mirror and I see that I am fine. I am revealed. And what is revealed is just fine. I don't mean the appearance of me exactly, more that with nothing covering me, nothing to hide behind or pretend with, entirely on show, I am nothing to be ashamed of. I feel as vulnerable as I have ever felt. But I am also strangely relieved and liberated. I am fine until a customer who has witnessed the proceedings while having his own prolific hair cut walks past me on his way out and says, "You look even better than when you came in. More badass." And then I dissolve into tears and the beautiful angel, Al, quietly continues to give an artistic finish to my shaven head. We begin to speak to each other. I tell him a bit about my cancer. He tells me about himself. He is Kurdish. His heart is breaking over what is happening to his people in northern Syria. He says Kurds are not safe even here. We are Muslims helping the West, he says. That makes us a target for those who think we are betrayers. We are in compassionate communion as Al carefully neatens my crop. What is happening to me is so utterly unimportant in the context of the continued destruction of his people. But the tender attention Al gives my unimportant hair is our place of communion. What I had dreaded with the deepest dread I had had in all this time since my cancer was diagnosed is become a transcendent experience in which I am attended by an angel of the first order. It is one of the best experiences of my life so far. I am profoundly blessed.
Yes, an extraordinary bit of writing. And I love the movement from this is the worst day to the best day of your life in a barber on a back street in central London, just through two human beings meeting each other. And that sense of...
Yes.
Of it cannot be hidden, the cancer became a freeing thing when you fully embodied so that the world could see what you're going through.
Yes, very well put, Gillian, if I may say so. Exactly, exactly. It was the final step, if you like.
Because we all cover ourselves in layers all the time, don't we? Of pretending, pretending that death's not going to happen. And that is the final elephant in the room, isn't it? And as we start, one of the reviewers of your book, I think Caroline Charters, isn't it, said this is not a book about dying, it's a book about how to live.
Well, I might live for quite a while. quite a while yet, so I need to listen to my own advice. I should say, incidentally, talking about This Is a Way to Live, that this experience has very much fed into the work I do at Westminster Abbey with public servants, because one of the things I'm very aware of with these people whom I work with is that they do have a carapace and need to have a carapace, a shell behind which they work, a professional face, if you like, because they do have to keep delivering professionally and consistently day after day after day, in a sense, whatever's going on with them. And sometimes, I mean, particularly you think of politicians, have the most horrendous things thrown at them. And if you don't have some protection, you get very, very badly hurt. But you must pay attention to the person behind the shell, behind the carapace, behind the professional persona. And so we do a lot of work on that. And it's using both Ignatian techniques and comedy, if I may say so, where you make friends with your shadow self, you know, just like the person sitting with the person with cancer. And all the experiences that I've had in this way have fed into this sort of really subtle work with politicians and civil servants and police and armed forces and all those sorts of people, journalists.
And it's dealing with uncertainty, isn't it? Because we all live with uncertainty, but looking like a person with cancer, you're sort of living that uncertainty that most of us try to ignore all the time. And I don't know how you felt when we went into lockdown from a global pandemic in the first few weeks, when they did all the things that I didn't think they could possibly, they shut the schools. And I've got two young kids, nightmare. And so many things that happened. And I suddenly, after a couple of weeks, I remembered, I've been here before. Like, I've had an experience of the world being turned up and down before. And I wondered if that was a similar experience for you. We've dealt with uncertainty in heat and spades before, haven't we?
That's right. That's right. And now it feels as though one has many companions on the way. Sure, yeah. So there's nothing personal about this experience now. And I'm so astonished and amazed and impressed by the way so many people have walked towards that and embraced it and made something of it and found in it sources of healing and help and hope, not just bitterness and suffering, although heaven knows there's been plenty of that.
Yeah. And also, I think what comes over to me is your emphasis of this hard-won discovery, if you like. And luckily you have the gift of writing and communicating so the rest of us can enjoy it. But this what you discover through the suffering and the uncertainty is this deep sense of joy at the center, and being and not in a pithy way, but you know, being stuck in an isolation room, you know, going through deep physical suffering, to still be looking out for the connection with other people and the connection with the world around you, and into finding joy. I think that's extraordinary.
What is really important about that is that you have to go through the pain to find it. That it is not a happy ending. This is not motherhood and apple pie. It's not Panglossian and it's not Pollyanna. It's really, I want to swear, but I won't. I'm trying to not to. Really hard. And this is, I think, what Julian teaches us. This is what she asked for. And you wish it away. Neither is it masochistic, or at least I hope it isn't. It's just, and of course the Christian story immeasurably helps, because you know that Christ has walked through this to walk towards it and through it and realize the joy. But the joy is, Ignatius talks about finding your place of consolation, finding your place of desolation, feeling your way to your place of desolation, and there you will find consolation, but only there. And so you have to be courageous, and turning out in the support of others, the support of Sean and the dear readers, and others' prayers all help that. You're not alone in it. Julian helped that.
And with you mentioned right at the beginning of our conversation, the sort of Pascal narrative of diagnosis and treatment and
and the condition you now live in, alongside sort of the Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and the Resurrection. Do you see your stem cells bit as the Holy Saturday bit, or are you feeling this is, well, you're just seeing we're an extended Holy Saturday, and we've moments of resurrection when you meet all the hairdresser, or you know, you get a good email, you know, in what sense are you still living that, or is it more that, you know, you just discovered that, you know, it is through that Holy Saturday experience that you find God?
Yes, and the resurrection comes again and again and again. So it comes every, so I have my treatment on Wednesday, Thursday is awful, on Friday morning I wake up and it's, I feel the wellness stealing back into my cells, and it's like a resurrection. It's like I've been through a Good Friday, Holy Saturday resurrection each time I have the chemotherapy. And certainly after the stem cell transplant, as the stem cells started to do their work, the new stem cells, that was like a resurrection. But I am still in Holy Saturday, and that's why it feels so hard, because it's, you know, one is trudging through. And I'm nervous, Gillian, about the 14th of July, which hopefully will be the last day of my treatment, because I've waited for this day for so long. And yet this cancer doesn't go away, you know, and I can't be too excited. I think everybody who comes out of chemotherapy and treatment must feel this. You have to somehow, you dare to hope, but the hope is, it is the cost of the hope too much, because the pain of it coming back and the hopes being dashed, and the way cancer can play with you like a cat plays with a mouse, and not wanting that, but also not wanting to deny the life that's rising up in me, and the looked for joy and relief of well, it'd be the 16th of July, I suppose, when I feel better after that last infusion. It's very hard. It's very hard. And there's a dynamic about it. And I think this is, again, crucifixion, resurrection dynamic because part of me thinks, well, let's just accept the mortality and kind of go to sleep under it and make one's peace with it. But it's not what happens. And I felt that in my body, physically, in the isolation room, that life wants to live, and it grows in you, and you see it in the spring, and it, you can't deny it, and you wouldn't want to deny it, but the cost of that is that it will also die.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's always a place of tension, isn't it? But a whole, you know, it's sort of like you've got the whole life, but in a very focused way. I've got a disabled friend who's physically disabled, and he sort of says, well, pointing at me, he said, well, you're a tab. As a temporarily able-bodied person, that's how we in the disabled community think of you, because you're born disabled, you will probably die in some way disabled. You're just living in a bubble where you're not thinking about it all the time. But going through sort of extreme treatment. And of course, the other aspect is other people want you to desperately be well again. So on the 16th of July, the 14th, 16th, you know, they'll be thinking, yay, we don't need to, you know, this, you know, it's, you know, and then you're handling their relief while keeping your own worries and doubts as well. And what I was particularly struck with some of your writing around this is, you consider this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Claire, not a terminal diagnosis, but a condition that you live with.
Yes, that's right.
How useful that is for everyone to understand that we all live with conditions. And in some ways, the reason I'm interested in this, I've got a child who's got a non-life limiting, well, we thought he was really ill, but it turns out to be a condition, and he's only 7. So we keep saying, you know, you're not ill. It's a condition. It's who you are. And using that language, I found, you know, he's only 7. I'm sure he's thinking about Lego really, but I'm thinking, well, that's a liberation for him. Cause I'm teaching him, like, his body's, you know, got bits and bobs that don't work sometimes so well, but it's who you are. It's, you know, his identity now.
Mm. I think, and this is something I think people who are evidently disabled teach us, that we are all disabled. We are. It's just that it shows a bit more on some people. Yeah. And we need to learn that and be comfortable with it and embrace it and not look for this weird notion of perfection. It's simply not true of anybody. Mm. Mm.
Is there any bit you want to read as we come to the end?
This was as we were going into the first lockdown. So this is right at the end of the book. Sunday, 22nd March, 2020, this is. I read on the Myeloma UK website that in the next few days I will be advised to self-isolate for 12 weeks. So be it. Here's my prayer of preparation. God! Help me to let the waves of fear pass over and away. Help me to be porous, not prickly, with the universe. Help me to practice what quietens my mind, what generates energy, what makes me laugh, what helps me sleep. Help me to think of a good, disciplined way to spend time online. Help me prepare my stubborn soul to ask for help. I really need help with this. Help me to understand that I am helping just by staying safe. Amen. As I write the prayer, my heart falters and my tears fall. So many more miles to go. How will I bear it? Like this. I put on some lipstick, straighten my shoulders, open my heart, and walk towards the next challenge.
Claire, you've mentioned Julian of Norwich a number of times in this podcast. And the most famous thing that most people know that she wrote, if they know anything about her, is that she wrote that all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. In what way do you find that comforting as you carry on, whatever this pandemic means, and for your years ahead, all shall be well?
It's a soothing balm. I mean, actually, that's one of my least favourite sayings of Julian, because it sounds a bit Panglossian, a bit too easy. But of course, her saying it, given what she's been through and what she's able to describe, it does have meaning. And I'm a lovely thing someone said recently that I thought was a good interpretation to this was, she said, everything will turn out all right. And if it isn't all right, it isn't the end. You know, it hasn't come to an end yet. And so, I do find it comforting. The more comforting phrase I have from her is, you shall not be tempted. God did not say you shall not be tempested and tried. And what God did say was, you shall not be overcome. Mm. And that someone sent that to me when I was at my absolute lowest ebb in the hospital. And it was the most fantastic gift. Ian Christie sent it to me.
Claire, thank you so much for giving us your time on the Go Health podcast. Everyone needs to buy this book and read this book, because it's about how to live well, and how to live fearlessly and find the joy and be porous. I think what I'm going to remember about our conversation, I'm going to try and be porous the rest of the day. I think it's a beautiful day. Because all this sort of be mindful, be in the moment. Oh, we've heard it so many times, but be porous is like an interaction, isn't it, in the world that we're living in. And I really, really love that.
Thank you. It's been a complete pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
So that was my conversation with Claire Gilbert. Thank you so much for listening. It was incredibly moving and inspiring to chat with her. And I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed recording it. But you know what? It was quite a tough one. I nearly cried at least once chatting to her. Incredibly inspiring, but really quite tough stuff. And so if you found you're feeling a bit fragile or emotional right now, because she was going into some really difficult aspects of life around cancer, treatment and remission, if you're finding it tough, do take a moment for yourself right now. Just pause, take a moment to pray, take a moment to take care of yourself. And we have got a busy time coming up in the Guild. We have got our first ever Advent journey. It's called Waiting Well. You can sign up today over on the website. Just look under courses, or it's right there on the menu. Sign up today and get emails every single day of Advent. That's from the 28th of November, directly into your inbox. Emails full of wisdom, inspiration, prayers, and practices to deepen your spirituality, to deepen your connection with God, to explore the issue of waiting, to find ways to improve your health, your hope, your patience throughout the holy season of Advent as we wait for the birth of Jesus. It is completely free to Go Health members, but you know, if you're not a member of the community, it's only £4 to join, and you get so much more. You get monthly bundle of resources, there's events, there's communities. It's fantastic. So do check that out, Waiting Well, the Advent Journey with the Go Health Community. All of the information is on our website and across social media on Facebook and Twitter. We've recorded a really cool little film about Waiting Well with the words of Paula Guder, who recorded our next podcast in this season. So we've used a bit of her wisdom on waiting and Advent to create a cool little film. So do check it out on our website and across social media. It is all happening there at the moment in the Guild. There's so many other things going on, so do check it out. I only have time to really talk about the Waiting Well Advent Journey. So rate and subscribe to this podcast if you're still listening to me. We want as many people as possible to experience these healing conversations and connect into us. That would be so amazing to rate and subscribe to this podcast. And yeah, I've already given it away. The next podcast is with Dr. Paula Guder, who is Canon Chancellor of St. Paul's Cathedral in London and a very notable theologian. So do look out for that. If you subscribe to our podcast today, you won't miss it. So in the meantime, God bless. Let's connect and chat. Let's keep learning to heal, because together we flourish.